good morning. Right? There's only two ways to quiet a crowd of Lutherans. One is to tap on a water glass, and the other one is to say, "The Lord be with you." Let's open with a prayer, please. Gracious God, for the gift of another day, we have hearts full of thanks. We are grateful also to be together in a peaceful place where we can ponder together all kinds of things we seldom have time to think about elsewhere. We ask that you be with us this morning as we study the scriptures, as we use them as a lens to see ourselves, to see our world, to see our lives, and to find in that vision that you give us the promise for our own day, the promise of your never-ending, steadfast love for all of us and for your world. Use this time that we might be in service to you and to that world. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
My name is Fred Niedner. In the other world, I teach biblical theology at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And I'm very grateful to be here. I always tell people that I love coming here because I get to do all the things that I really enjoy doing, and I don't have to do all the things that I don't. The latter being grading papers. And I actually teach for free. They pay me to grade papers. And then there are committee meetings, which mercifully one is mostly spared up here. I'm sort of a newbie in terms of Holden years. I've only been coming up here for 20 years. Many people have been coming up here for 40 and more, 50 years, but I'm only just past my Holden teenage years. In fact, I was just pondering walking down the hill to the class this morning that the first time I came up here, my youngest child was 9 months old, and on one of the first days I was here, I wasn't paying close attention. We all used cloth diapers in those days, and I accidentally flushed a diaper down the toilet up in Chile 7. And at the end of the day, I got a very curt note from the plumber, who informed me that people usually take diapers out of the toilet before they flush them. I was dutifully instructed. So, this Bible study, with its odd themes up there on the kiosk, will eventually be about the prophet Ezekiel, which is the prophet whose work the theme verse for this summer is taken, the verse about living waters that give life to the things along the banks in which it flows. But the more I studied that and thought about doing such things as doing a lot of water texts all over the Bible living water texts in particular, the more I thought, well, Ezekiel as a whole is worth a good look nowadays for a variety of reasons, particularly in the most narrow sense. You can't really understand the meaning of the theme verse about the living water and the stream of living water unless you understand the context in which the prophet Ezekiel did his work, his ministry, which was, of course, the disastrous times of the exile of the Israelites, the Judeans, the people who had lost everything in the attack by the Babylonians. And so we're going to take a running start and study look at together the problem of the exile, theological problem, as well as simply the human brokenness that comes from losing a war. And we're going to put Ezekiel's whole ministry and this theme verse in particular into context. Ezekiel was a person one of a small group of people, so far as we can tell, who in effect had to reinvent the religion of Israel. In some ways, it's remarkable that the thing we know of as the religion of Israel survived the exile. Most people's religions in the ancient world, when they experienced, or when the people experienced something like what Israel did in 586 BC, left their old traditions behind. Why stick with a loser god? Go with a winner. The people of Jerusalem would have had every reason to quit on the tradition that most of them knew, fractured as it was already by that time. But a small group of people reinvented the Israelite religion so that it was worth keeping. And Ezekiel was one of these people. And so we're going to look at Ezekiel as a kind of a reinventor of a tradition for people who would have every reason to simply quit. The longest single storyline in the Bible is the story of the wilderness. The story that goes from mid-Exodus to the end of Deuteronomy. That whole story, that whole block of literature is set during that 40-year period between bondage in Egypt and arrival in the Promised Land. And that's a body of literature that teaches you, among other things, how to live in between those two states, bondage and freedom. And the longer you study that, the more you realize that no one gets out of that transitional stage alive. We are always somewhere between bondage and freedom. We live our lives there, as did the wilderness generation. Nobody who started the journey got out alive. It was the next generation who knew the closest thing to the freedom that the slaves were promised. And that's a kind of a truism about life, that we mostly live in the wilderness between bondage of some kind and the freedom for which we hope. So learning to live in the wilderness is one of life's great challenges. The largest single group of documents that we have in the Bible were put into the shape that we have them during the time of the exile, including the story of the wilderness. That was put into the shape we have it during the time of the exile, because exile is by nature another time when you are not where you think you ought to be. You are not where you properly belong. You are in some kind of transition, or at least you hope it's a transition. And it will indeed be at least some kind of a transition while you get used to the fact that you're never going to be where you thought you should be again. So there's a bit of similarity between exile and wilderness. Neither one is a place where anybody really truly wants to be. But oddly enough, exile, like wilderness, is another one of those places where we almost always are, at least in one sense or another. We're never quite where we thought we should be. And I'm going to try to use Ezekiel and his prophecies and the whole business of reinventing a tradition in a time of crisis like exile to help us think about at least some of the dimensions of the world of faith and of church and of being God's people in an era when, at least by some measures, we're not quite where we think we belong. We live in a different place and in a different time than at least what some of us grew up in and thought we would always be able to take for granted. Things have shifted, and there's a sense in which lots of us find ourselves exiles. So that's the reason for doing at least some of what we're going to do here with exile, and in particular with Ezekiel. As just one or two other introductory things. I've been around Holden enough to know that Holden has, in its mission statement, a very important element that we call hilarity. So everything at Holden is supposed to have an element of that. And I explain here, I have for the last years that I've taught up here, I've explained that it's sort of giving fair warning to the people who come here. My students over the recent years have taught me that I am hilarity challenged. What I think is funny and what they think is funny or hilarious are quite different. And so I can't guarantee you that hilarity will happen in the course of a session. So I always try at the beginning to artificially make at least one moment of hilarity happen so that I've at least made an honest effort. So I have alleged hilarity to share with you. And I used to bring up all kinds of books of humor that Walt Bowman and others clued me into over the years. I thought this year I would just offer one little tidbit of advice at the beginning of each session. So that if there's nothing else useful, at least one thing might be helpful. And something I witnessed up at breakfast this morning triggered my first thought of this type. I witnessed I'll call it a debate between a father and looked to me like a 13-year-old daughter. And it wasn't going well. And so I remember a little principle I once learned, although I learned it in a slightly different way. There are two theories about how to argue with a 13-year-old girl. Neither one works. So, that's the little tidbit. So the title for the whole 2 weeks that I'll be doing up here is In Search of Living Water, Navigating Ezekiel's Visionary River. And today's session is called Exile, Exactly How Dry Was It? / Is It? And so we're going to look at the story that we have in the Bible of how Israel, how the people of Jerusalem and Judea, it is more accurately in the 6th century BC, slid into destruction and exile. And the portion of the Bible that tells this story begins in 2 Kings 21. So if you've got Bibles and you want to kind of follow along, that's the story that we're looking at. This is a running start of about a century because you can't fully understand what happened, or at least I don't think you can fully understand what happened unless you take that running start. And in fact, in the verses just before 2 Kings 21, you get the notice of the death of King Hezekiah, whom some of you may remember was one of the very few good kings. The narrator of 1 and 2 Kings tells you, in the case of every single king of either the southern kingdom Judah or the northern kingdom Israel, whether this king was a good king or a bad king. And virtually, all of the kings of the north were bad. Every single one of them, they were bad for one particular reason, and that is because they tolerated the worship of God outside Jerusalem. Jeroboam had built sanctuaries to God at Bethel and at Dan on the far north, far south and the far north of his kingdom. And there's a whole long story there that could teach us a lesson in reinvention theology. What had happened was that the people of David, King David, had stolen the Ark of the Covenant from the northerners, and they had parked it down in Jerusalem in an attempt to centralize all the symbols of power and authority in Jerusalem for the new monarchy that was still being shaped in David's time. Saul had given it a shot. David started to actually make it work, and among other things, he brought the Ark of the Covenant, which really belonged up in Shiloh in northern territory. I don't think the people of Philadelphia would be very pleased if we stole the Ark of the Covenant and stuck it in, say, Salt Lake City or something. But anyway, the Ark of the Covenant was even more sacred. The Ark of the Covenant was the throne of Yahweh. And it had atop it two cherubim. And that's where Yahweh was enthroned. We'll study this story, if you're still here next week, we'll look at this in a little bit greater detail, or later in this week, perhaps. Well, when Jeroboam and his people seceded and formed the northern kingdom, a couple generations later, they had to somehow or another have an alternative for the throne of Yahweh with its cherubim. So King Jeroboam put a cherub in Bethel at the far south of the kingdom and a cherub up in Dan on the far north in order to say, our whole nation is an ark of the covenant. Our whole nation is the throne of Yahweh. You guys down there think you got Yahweh in a box. And that you can only worship in Jerusalem, our whole place is an ark. Now, the southerners who got to write the story, what they said Jeroboam did was he talked the people into worshiping cows because a cherub had some features of a bull. And so the tradition actually condemns Jeroboam for worshiping golden calves, when all he did was turn his nation into a bigger ark than they had down there. So Jeroboam was doing a little bit of reinventing. But the southerners rejected that. They lasted longer. They got to write the story. And so every single king that followed in the line of Jeroboam in the north, and there was no dynasty up there that lasted. But every king of the north who kept those sanctuaries going was condemned for being a wicked, evil king. Even though that was the area that was most zealously worshipers of Yahweh. The southerners down around Jerusalem wasn't even an Israelite city. It was a Jebusite city that David captured and made his capital. So the people down there, I mean, they came from a little bit of everywhere. That was not the zealous Yahweh worshipers of the north. But in any case, the story we're going to be following is the story of Jerusalem, where they still had the temple and the Ark of the Covenant and all the traditions that went with the Davidic dynasty. And even down in the south, where you couldn't be condemned for worshiping cows like the northerners, all but three or four of the kings are judged as having been wicked and evil. And one of the very few good ones was Hezekiah, who dies just as we're going to start the story in 2 Kings 21. Hezekiah was judged to have been, if we flip back just a little bit, and I got to quit going backwards or we're never going to go forward. He was judged to have been the best king ever, a few verses earlier than where we're starting. more zealous for Yahweh than anybody who came before him or after him. Why? Because he made sure that worship happened in Jerusalem the way it was supposed to be happening. And we'll see what his son did when Hezekiah took over and reversed all the policies, and we'll get a read on what kind of politics of religion is really going on here. So Hezekiah, a great king, dies, and his son Manasseh, 12 years old, began to reign after him, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, following the abominable practices of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. He rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had destroyed. He erected altars for Baal, made a sacred pole. That's also part of a form of Baal worship. As King Ahab of Israel had done, he worshipped all the hosts of heaven. That's the sort of the astral religion of the Assyrians and others to the east. And he built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem I will put my name." He built altars for all the hosts of heaven, and so forth and so forth. He made his son pass through fire, practiced soothsaying and augury, dealt with mediums and wizards, did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. We'll pause there. You get the picture. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign. So it's a boy king. I don't know about your experience, but in my experience, 12-year-old children are not all that given to the politics and statecraft and obsession over the gross domestic product and such things as people a little bit older. So what does it mean to have a 12-year-old king who suddenly reverses all the policies of his father? Well, obviously it means his father had political enemies, and somehow or another they were able to control the son. And they were scared of what Hezekiah's policies meant for the long-term viability of the country, and they quickly reversed them as soon as Hezekiah was dead. And Manasseh, 12-year-old child, is induced to go along with this and to be the figurehead for this big change. Now, why would they do all these things? And even if they did, even if this is a slight exaggeration, which many scholars believe it is, why would Manasseh open up the nation once again to all the religions of the neighboring peoples after Hezekiah had systematically stopped all this? Well, one thing at least that was going on was that Hezekiah had listened to prophets like Isaiah, who forbade anyone to make alliances and treaties with other nations. There's that famous story in Isaiah 1 to 15, actually, which includes Isaiah 7:14, the thing about a young woman shall conceive and bear a child and call his name Emmanuel. And before that child is able to say yes and no and gets off of baby food, the nations that you're worried about won't even exist anymore, and you don't have to sweat their threat any longer. That's a story in which Isaiah is teaching the kings the foolishness of making treaties with other nations. We have God on our side. Those other nations, they have kings and gods and whatnot. We don't need to worry about them. And what the prophets hated about making treaties was, when you made a treaty, you had to allow the worship of the other nations in your territory. Because the treaty was not just between you and the other king, or you and the other people, but between your gods. So the practice of making treaties in order to stave off larger enemies who were threatening some of these smaller nations roundabout involved bringing in all these practices of various kinds of religion that was at least to some extent foreign to the Israelites. Now, we should also probably admit, and we don't have to go into this very much, we often get the picture from the Bible that all the Israelites thought alike. You know, like in the wilderness, there were actually, you know, a couple million people out there at least. And sometimes the text says, and then all Israel said thus and so to Moses. Can you imagine 2 million people agreeing on anything? So what we're getting is kind of a hierarchical picture of what was going on. You know, this is the picture of what the government officials said was going on in the nation. What we really don't know is how many of the local farmers got involved in Baal religion for reasons that had nothing to do with statecraft. So it's probably a whole lot more complicated than it looks. But in any case, to make a story like this, what seems to have happened was, for the sake of keeping the nation intact and threatening off the dangers of the big empires that surrounded Jerusalem, Manasseh's handlers reverted to the practice of making treaties with all sorts of other nations and tolerated all these different religions in Jerusalem. And Manasseh, therefore, himself as king, got involved in all sorts of stuff, including child sacrifice and every conceivable evil that you can trot out against a king of Israel or Judah is brought up against Manasseh, to the point that the narrator tells us that God decided then and there, in the days of Manasseh, that this was it. This was the last straw. God was going to destroy Jerusalem. So chapter 21, verses 13 or so, or verse 12. Therefore, thus says the Lord, I'm bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such evil that the ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. I'll stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line for Samaria, the plummet for the house of Ahab. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. So think of the compost thing up here in the dining hall, cleaning the plate. I'll even wipe off the crumbs from the plate of Jerusalem. Cast off the remnant of my heritage, give them into the hand of their enemies, they'll become prey and spoil, and so forth. And then a little another summary of all Manasseh's evils and bloodshed and so forth. And Manasseh reigned for 55 years. So in terms of, you know, if you hear of a politician who rules in a volatile part of the world in a very dangerous time and keeps his country intact and his administration in place for 55 years, that's a successful reign. He kept the place afloat. But this narrator condemns him as the worst king ever and the reason why God had to destroy the whole place. So Manasseh died. If you want to read the rest of his story, you could look it up in the book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah. He slept with his ancestors, and he was buried in the Garden of Uzzah. And his son Amon succeeded him, and he too was evil, but he only lasts a couple years, and there's a revolt. The servants of Amon conspired against him and killed the king in his house, and the people of the land, much has written about them. That's an expression that seems to be a certain population group that had political and religious pieces to their ideology. They conspired against the people who put Amon in place, and they killed Amon and they set up their king Josiah, whose reign starts in chapter 22, who was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 31 years. Another boy king, and this time a different set of handlers. And as we're going to see, this king's handlers are going to reverse the policies of Manasseh and in effect go back to the policies of Hezekiah. So there's terrible pendulum swings in policy that has to do with how you relate to outsiders and what about the practice of the religion of Yahweh and the religion of all these other peoples. Do we make treaties or do we not make treaties? The pendulum is swinging back and forth generation to generation as people try to do their best to survive in a hostile world. Well, we're going to have to fast forward at least through some of Josiah's story, but this is critically important for everything that follows in the rest of the series and for people like Ezekiel. In the 18th year of King Josiah, I skipped a page. The king, by now an adult, has renovation of the temple going on, and this famous incident occurs that starts in verse 8, where a priest named Hilkiah finds a book of the law in the house of the Lord. Hilkiah gives the book to Shaphan. Shaphan gives it to the king, or at least reports it to the king. And when the king hears what's in this book, he is smitten to his core. He realizes that he and his people are in trouble, that they have not followed the ordinances that are in this book of the law that was found in the temple, which no one had ever seen before, the way the story goes. He decides they are in big trouble, and he puts a reform in place to follow that law to the letter. And he then has a major reformation of the people based on that book. And most of what he does is like what Hezekiah did, gets rid of all the worship that's going on anywhere else, especially the worship of the other gods like Baal and Asherah and the star gods of the Assyrians and so forth, and puts an end to all the mediums and the wizards and the child sacrifice and everything else. But what you can tell also that Josiah did, if you read all this, is that Josiah also put an end to the worship of Yahweh anywhere else but Jerusalem. Now, people had always been worshiping Yahweh in all kinds of places. Everyone had done that. No one had ever seen a law before that said you couldn't even worship Yahweh elsewhere. But this book that they found says, you cannot worship God anywhere but in the place where I choose my name to dwell. And a couple of the other things that Josiah does is he discovers in this book that kings are not supposed to have a lot of horses. Well, nobody had ever seen that before. Solomon was the greatest horse breeder in the world of his day. So Solomon didn't know that book. Nobody knew this book before. Kings weren't supposed to breed horses, and they weren't supposed to have a lot of wives. Obviously Solomon, you know, and some of the others. I mean, this book lays down a bunch of laws nobody had ever seen before. Well, if you go scouting through the canon to figure out what this is, a lot of you know this, what they discovered was a form of what we call the Book of Deuteronomy, because it's the Book of Deuteronomy the middle section of it anyway, that lays down this law in the form of a covenant that says that it'll be okay to have a king when you get into your land, but the king shall not multiply horses, and above all, the king shall not buy horses from Egypt. The king shouldn't have a lot of wives, and above all else, Deuteronomy 11 and 12 says, you shall not worship God anywhere except in the one place where I will cause my name to dwell. So no worship outside Jerusalem. And if you obey this law, nothing can happen to you. You will be safe. You will prosper. You will be blessed beyond all telling. But if you disobey this law, you will fall under this terrible list of curses that then follows, and you will be blistered and oppressed and slaughtered and ruined in every conceivable way. And if you want to read the most chilling description of what it would be like to live in a city under siege, you read the last chapters of Deuteronomy, which are set up as what you can expect if you disobey this law, but what almost everyone agrees is actually a report of what happened while they were under siege in Jerusalem in the last days of Jerusalem, and how they came to understand that this is what they got for disobeying the commandments. So anyway, they find this book in the temple, and they bring it to Josiah. At least this is how the story goes. And he obeys it perfectly. He puts in practice all these policies, even has to slaughter a whole lot of priests of Yahweh who want to worship elsewhere. They've had their worship practices up in Tekoa and Anathoth and all these other places where some of the prophets come from, actually, for generation upon generation, and they're supposed to all of a sudden stop worshiping Yahweh there now because of this crazy book Josiah's people found? I don't think so. So Josiah killed them all. He also slaughtered a whole lot of other people who refused to go along with his policies. And he did such a great job of following this book to the letter that the narrator in 2 Kings says of him in 2 Kings 23:24 and following. Moreover, Josiah put away the mediums, wizards, teraphim, idols, and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and Jerusalem, so that he established the words of the law that were written in the book of the priest Hilkiah, that the priest Hilkiah had found in the house of the Lord. Before him there was no king like him, who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any king, any like him, arise after him. Oddly, that's the same thing that was said of Hezekiah two generations earlier. But in any case, this guy did it. They found the book of the law that promises, if you obey this, nothing can happen to you. If you disobey it, you're doomed. They obeyed it. The narrator says he got it right. He did it perfectly. And yet look at verse 26. Still the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath, by which his anger was kindled against Judah, because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. The Lord said, I'll remove Judah also out of my sight, as I've removed Israel, and I will reject this city that I've chosen, Jerusalem, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there. I don't know what you make of that kind of theology, but this is a hard saying. They followed the covenant, which makes the promises, the blessings and curse promises that it makes. The narrator says they did it perfectly, and yet God still couldn't get over what grandfather Manasseh had done, So it didn't make any difference how well they obeyed under Josiah. They were going to lose anyway, because God just couldn't quite get over that.
You know, the Ten Commandments, it says it will go on to the third and fourth generation.
So yeah, but
precedent is there.
But the book of Deuteronomy also says you shall not punish a child for the sins of his father or his grandfather. So God doesn't abide by God's own principles. Or maybe God has a lot of principles and sort of abides by some of them, not by others. You know, God being God can pick and choose which principles. I mean, I'm being slightly facetious here. What we have here is a desperate theologian who's trying to explain how can it be that we follow the covenant that we found to the letter and got destroyed anyway.
What about the means that he chose to do this? Slaughtering everybody? This is a good thing?
Well, what's happening is these are theologians trying to make sense of their experience. What we're reading from, though some of you know all of this, on the chance that a few of you don't, what we're reading from, the whole business of Joshua, Judges, the books of Samuel, the books of Kings, are the story of Israel's life in the land, put together from stuff like is mentioned here. You know, if you want to read the rest of Manasseh's story, you look in the book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah. So the narrator tells you, there's other stuff, but I'm telling you this story. And the person who's putting this story together, what we now have in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, is put together during the exile, after Israel has lost the land. And it's looking back over the whole history of their life in the land and asking, what happened? How did this occur that we, the people of God, could be destroyed like this and lose everything? And is there any chance we'll get it back? And as some of you know, this whole long complex of stuff is called the Deuteronomistic history, because it's put together by somebody who judges everyone, even before or after the book was found in Josiah's time, on whether or not they lived up to the book of Deuteronomy. And of course, nobody had ever heard of it until the generation before they lost everything. But everyone is judged by whether or not they followed that covenant. And of course, most people didn't, because they worshipped outside Jerusalem. So this is a curious kind of history. But the real point of this history, which begins with the story of God giving the land to the Israelites as a gift at the cost of all the blood of the people who used to live there. This is a land very precious because of what it cost for you to have in terms of human life. And then in the book of Judges, you see the story of how over and over again they fall away, and then they have to repent, and they are restored by the efforts of some leader who we call a judge. And this happens over, every story in Judges is exactly the same. They just have different characters and details. But the outline of every single story is the same. Falling away, repenting, being restored, living in peace for a while, falling away, being conquered, repenting, being restored, over and over and over again. That's the pattern. And maybe God will repeat it one more time. Now that we have fallen away and lost everything, maybe we will be just, if we repent, we'll be restored one more time. But this book also wants to blame everything that happened on certain kings. Kings who made treaties, allowed the religion of other cultures and nations to be practiced on their territory and got involved in those religions. And Manasseh is the great symbol of why God finally had to destroy the people, regardless of how faithful Josiah was. So that's one thing this book teaches. God can get so angry that it doesn't make any difference how faithful you are. For the sins of your grandfather, God might just wipe you out. How else do we explain what happened? So Josiah gets killed in a battle, fighting against the Egyptians. His son Jehoahaz takes over, and within 20 years, the whole thing slides into chaos. We could look very briefly at the story. The Egyptians changed Jehoahaz's name to Jehoiakim, and he became a vassal king to the Egyptians. He reigned 25 years and went back to the practices of Manasseh, apparently, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Then along comes the Babylonians in chapter 24, and they first just make a subject state out of Judah and Jerusalem, and they take away a bunch of exiles, including King Jehoiachin, and Ezekiel is among the exiles that is taken away during this time, and so he's not mentioned here, of course, but we'll eventually hark back to this. He's among the people that's hauled off to Babylon during this period before the destruction. And finally, a king named Zedekiah, who is the last king in Jerusalem, presumes to try to rebel against the Babylonian Empire. And so the Babylonians put their final siege to Jerusalem and broke through after they starved and in every other way humiliated and debased the people inside the city. And when they finally broke through, look please for just a moment at chapter 25, verse 6. They captured the king, brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, slaughtered his sons before his eyes, then put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him in fetters and took him to Babylon. So the last thing that the last king ever saw was his children being slaughtered before his eyes, and then they gouged them out and haul him away into exile. And then you get the story of the pillage and the taking of everything worth anything off to Babylon.
I'm not aware of all this, but I'm just interested. The whole narrative of, in some ways, God's people talking God into the whole king system, and the whole attitude of, during that whole period. Has anybody really explored the relevancy of, say, following the letter of the law but not the heart of the law, or the whole idea of earthly kingdom and those whole issues and God's response to that whole period?
Yeah, you could probably do close to a week's Bible studies just on the subject of the views of kings and politics, even in just the Pentateuch and the Deuteronomistic history. Yeah, Deuteronomy says, when you get to the land that I will show you and take you to, and when you ask for a king, that's fine. No problem. It's just that the king can't multiply horses, take a lot of wives and make himself filthy rich.
They didn't want an earthly king model, maybe?
Well, that's not part of Deuteronomy.
Okay.
Deuteronomy's fine with kings. No problem. But that crazy story in 1 Samuel 8, when they ask for a king, like the other nations have, and that phrase is also in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy says, when you get up to your land and you want a king like the other nations have, that's fine. But in 1 Samuel 8, when Samuel first hears this request and goes to God, God says, oh, that's terrible. That's the worst thing I ever heard of. It's rebellion against me. I'm their only king. But go ahead. They won't listen otherwise. So go ahead, point them a king. It's going to be terrible. You're going to hate them. They're going to tax your... They're going to really tax you.
Medicare, Medicare even, and Social Security.
Yeah, we're going to have the military-industrial complex, the IRS. You're going to have all the evils that you get with centralized government, but go ahead.
Not my fault.
That's right. And when you complain about it, I'm not going to listen. You'll just stew in your own juices. It's a terrible idea, absolutely terrible idea. I reject it. That's what 1 Kings says about monarchy. Well, then, oddly enough, by the time you get to 2 Samuel 7, God says, man, this king thing is the greatest deal since sliced bread. Let's keep it going forever. You be my son, I'll be your father. Yay! Always a king on the throne in Jerusalem forever. Woohoo! God must have had a conversion experience between
this
1 Kings.
What? This chunk that you're talking about of Deuteronomy that was missing. Do they know where this came from? Who was the author?
Well, that's the point, is that there's a whole lot of different points of view about monarchy embedded in this material. You know, the ancient Israelites were just like us. You got 19 people, you got 20 opinions when it comes to politics. And there were, I'm just kidding. There would only be like 15 opinions. But there were terribly intense debates among them, just like there are about us, over this kind of stuff. How should we rule ourselves? And the major parties, if you will, were the prophets, who thought there should be theocracy and that they should be the people who got to say what happened. There was the monarchy party, who believed that monarchy should be allowed to rule, and they were the wise people. They knew everything. They, you know, and they hated the prophets mostly, and kings were constantly killing prophets. And eventually, there's the priestly group that arises, and the priests want all the authority, and the priests finally get all the authority in the post-exilic period. It's 10:05, we'll discuss from here on. But there was no one point of view, even in the Bible, about these things. There's theological debate embedded all through this material. And there's theological debate about exactly whose fault it was that they ended up destroyed. The narrator of the Deuteronomistic history says it was all the king's fault. If the kings hadn't been so wicked, none of this would have happened to us. But God had to do this because the kings forced him into it. They're looking to explain their experience, just like we do. When something horrible happens to us, we always ask why. How did this happen to us? And the Deuteronomistic history says, our kings sold us down the river with their wicked behavior.
Seems like this desperate theologian would have done a little better not to set up Josiah so
poorly. Well... yeah, or to put it in another way, you play a dangerous game when you set up Deuteronomy as the be-all and the end-all of theology. When you make theology into a covenant, in which you guarantee that the obedient will be blessed, mm-hmm. and only the wicked will suffer. Mm-hmm. And a whole lot of the rest of post-exilic theology wrestles with that, including books like Job. But this is hardwired into us, I tell you. The book of Deuteronomy is the theology that we love by nature. If I obey, I deserve to be rewarded, and only when I disobey do I deserve to be punished. So I will obey, and therefore I will have control over my future. God will have to bless me if I obey. So I will obey to the letter. And then God is bound to bless me. Deuteronomic theology will always fail. Sooner or later, it crashes. So the Deuteronomic theology is flawed at its base. And it could have taken the whole tradition down. Because if you really believe this, if you really believe the Deuteronomic theology, you have to believe that God betrayed you. Because you obeyed, and God destroyed you anyway. Why follow a God who doesn't keep God's promises? Why obey a God who makes a treaty with you, a covenant with you, like the book of Deuteronomy is, and then lets you be destroyed anyway when you're obedient? So in books like Job's supposed friends, who are really harassers, they come along and say, well, you must have done something bad, Job. You must have done something to deserve this. What are your secret sins that you didn't tell us about? Because Deuteronomic theology says, if you obey, nothing can happen to you. So Job, there's something you're not telling us. There's got to be an explanation. And we have to know it so that we can get back in control. So we can do the right thing and never be destroyed. Well, we got 20 seconds. I want to say one more thing. The three great promises with which Israel lived were that the land would be theirs forever. That was promised to Abram back in Genesis. That there would always be a Davidic king on the throne in Jerusalem, which is promised to David in 2 Samuel 7. And that the temple where God had chosen his name to dwell would always be the place where God's eyes and God's heart dwelt forever. That's in 1 Kings 10. If you think about it, at this moment, they have lost the land, the king, and the temple, and all the promises of God have come to naught. They have nothing. And God's promises, what do they still mean? This is what I call in my title, how dry it was when people like Ezekiel come on the scene and try to help this people figure out what now. In the total, after the total breakdown of our theology, now what? Is it worth following Yahweh, who's probably dead in the rubble of the temple anyway? Okay, we're out of time.
On that hopeful note.